remain the underpinning of U.S. giving, and in turn have greatly influenced an era of burgeoning philanthropic enterprise around the world. At the heart of Carnegie's essay, as Walker read it, was the idea of extreme inequality as an unavoidable condition of the free market system, and of philanthropy as an effective remedy. You can picture an executive at KKR reading this and nodding. Yeah, exactly, unavoidable. But then Walker began to go off script. The giving world, he wrote, needed to openly acknowledge and confront the tension inherent in a system that perpetuates vast differences in privilege and then tasks the privileged with improving the system. Here Walker was already breaking the Carnegie Pact. He was questioning the idea of the rich as the best and rightful administrators of the surplus of the society. He was refusing to confine his analysis to what happens after fortunes are made in the marketplace. He was interested in how those fortunes are made and what choices have occasioned them. What underlying forces drive the very inequality whose manifestations we seek to ameliorate, he asked. Walker suggested that we are crashing into the limits of what we can do with a 19th century interpretation of philanthropy's founding doctrine. And he said Martin Luther King Jr. might offer a useful complement to Carnegie's encrusted ideas, with his call to laud philanthropy, while not ignoring the circumstances of economic injustice which make philanthropy necessary. King had argued that the circumstances of economic injustice, when examined, had something to do with the people in power, and that true generosity might mean restrained taking, not just a belated shedding of some of what had been taken. Inequality, by Carnegie's lights, was a natural byproduct of progress. The economy changes, a new technology is invented, and some figure out how to seize on it, and their wealth surges and others are left in their humble cottages. Walker complicated this picture by arguing that inequality is built on antecedents, pre-existing conditions ranging from ingrained prejudice and historical racial, gender, and ethnic biases to regressive tax policies that cumulatively define the systems and structures that enable inequality to fester. He was suggesting that people aren't left behind and left out because they fail to take advantage of change. Many are born doomed because of who they are or their parents or great-great-grandparents were, because of where they live, because of their color or disabilities, and because of the political choices the society has made about how to treat them. This, in Walker's view, made it important to go beyond Carnegie's idea of temporary inequality as the price of progress. Wealthy individuals needed to ask themselves, is the playing field on which I accumulated my wealth level and fair? Does the system privilege people like me in ways that compound my advantages? Were the rich, as Carnegie had presented them, the transitory guardians of progress's fruits, or were they hereditary hoarders of that progress? Walker was arguing that the society must have a say not only in what happens to great wealth, but also in how great wealth comes to be. Without that, in his telling, the philanthropist is fighting against himself, perpetuating, even worsening by day, the very suffering he seeks to soothe after dusk. The privileged, Walker went on, now benefit from the further advantage of having their language and mentality dominate other domains, including the giving world. They no longer just enjoy the privilege of nice homes and cars. They also now have a say over how so many public problems are solved. When we talk about economic inequality, he said, we might acknowledge an underlying unspoken hierarchy in which we relate everything back to capital. In most areas of life, we have raised market-based, monetized thinking over all other disciplines and conceptions of value. Walker was presenting the power of the big giver as dangerous. Foundations like his were hobbled by inherited, assumed, paternalist instincts. Western givers tended to treat recipients in poor countries as subjects to be ordered around, as implementers rather than partners. Big philanthropy needed to get better at modeling the kind of equality we hope to achieve by listening and learning and lifting others up. Walker wrote that foundations, built, like Ford, on the fortunes of powerful people, often wielding enormous power themselves, needed to ask hard questions about their own authority and remove from reality. How does our privilege insulate us from engaging with the most difficult root causes of inequality and the poverty in which it ensnares people? In 2,000 words, Walker had shaken the intellectual platform on which market world philanthropy had long stood. The publication of the letter marked a reconciliation of his long dissonance. Like Hillary Cohen and Amy Cuddy, he had both worked the system and worried about it, had grappled with how to position himself relative to it, whether to be quiet or walk away or challenge it. The letter only mattered because he had worked the system long enough and well enough to rise to the presidency of the Ford Foundation. But the letter could perhaps only have been written by a man who had known the wrong end of that system before he ascended it, and who refused to let himself enjoy the climb without also making it useful. The Lincoln warmed up Third Avenue in thick midday traffic as Walker thought through the proper approach for KKR. The nature of his burden had been inverted by the issuance of his new gospel. Now that he had spoken one of the more uncomfortable truths in his arena, his task had changed. It was to stay in the game, to keep the powerful listening, to challenge his plutocrat friends without scaring them away. As the Lincoln surged some inches and halted and surged again, Walker pondered the pushback he got from these friends, the pleas to stop ranting at inequality, to speak of opportunity instead. He wondered what the criticism was telling him. Were these rich people aligned with his ideals deep down, wanting the same kind of society he wanted, but preferring gentler, more inviting language for it? Or did he and they want fundamentally different things? At first he defended them, revealing the open-heartedness that had won their confidence over the years. "They may not use his language of inequality," he said, "but they actually would say, no, I do want a world with his opportunity." He understood their uneasiness about the word inequality, and why some of his friends felt he was hassling them. It was because, for so many of the winners he had come to know, their narrative of themselves was not of privilege, but struggle. "I'm not some privileged kid," he imagined them saying. "I'm working my ass off. I'm busting my ass out here pitching to these jerks, trying to raise money from them or trying to sell my widgets or whatever it is. So don't tell me I'm privileged. I'm getting up every day at 4 o'clock and on the train from Rye and coming to New York, da-da-da." A moment later, he reconsidered his own magnanimity. "I think it's hard, often, for them to want what I want," he said. "It's hard to reconcile, because what I want means they would have to give up something. And so the crux of it is, in order to reduce inequality, we actually have to talk about redistribution. We have to talk about equity, and that will impact them." What he wanted, and what he had spent a long time earning the chance to call for, was a reining in of the power of people like them. He wanted them to pay higher taxes. He wanted them to give up their legacy preferences at the leading universities. He said, "All my friends who want to talk about education, you say, let's talk about legacy programs. Do we really think legacy preferences, when we're getting rid of affirmative action, shouldn't we be getting rid of legacy? Oh, hell no. People will be like, oh, absolutely not." What might have worried his critics the most was Walker's view that money-making had to change. It was one thing to say that rich people needed to pay higher taxes and stop sneaking their children into Harvard. It was another to suggest, as he now did, that the very industry he was about to visit was predatory. One of the fundamental challenges of private equity is so much of what they are about is efficiency and extracting value from their portfolio companies. And what that translates into is generating more productivity with less expense. So, basically, firing people, laying people off, he said. "We know the productivity of the last 20 years has been not to the benefit of workers. Workers' income is flat. Those resources were extracted," he said, "and now show up as returns for firms like KKR. Some of that money will end up in charity, soothing the wounds it helped to cut." If this was what Walker planned to say at KKR, it would surely be one of the more lively of their guest speaker luncheons. In spite of these ideas, Walker had a chance that few did to persuade an audience like this, because he knew how to talk to them, and because he didn't believe they were bad people. He did not malign them. He thought that they were trapped, as so many people in market world are, in a false dogma. He distilled the dogma thus. "You go out there, and you make as much money as you can in the world, and you do all you can to make our capitalist system work, and then you're a philanthropist. It's phased, and it's compartmentalized." What he had learned from observing the rich was how the dogma made it easier to feel like a good person. "Compartmentalizing is a means of coping," he said in the back of the limo. "And so, sure, there are things that they know, they see on a daily basis, that must, if they've got any morality, appall them. But they tell themselves that in my spare time, I'm going to be on that board in that school up in Harlem, or I'm going to mentor these three black boys in Bed-Stuy, and I'm going to get them to Yale. It makes them feel like decent citizens. The problem with it, Walker said, is that it allows you to park the part of your brain and your morality and your humanity that would make you demand something else of yourself and of the system. There are few families in modern American life who embody everything Walker was discussing, as well as the Sacklers. They are one of the country's richest families, and their lives intersected with Walker's at various points in the philanthropic galaxy, organizations he and they have donated to, an award he had received from a museum of which Elizabeth Sackler was a trustee. The Sacklers were Carnegie's old gospel incarnate. Give and give, honorably, thoughtfully, abundantly, and expect in return that questions will not be asked about the money's origins and the system that let it be made. The Sackler brothers, Elizabeth's father, Arthur, Raymond, and Mortimer, were doctors and co-founders of a pharmaceutical company that would come to be called Purdue Pharma. The brothers made large gifts to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which opened a Sackler wing as a result, the Guggenheim, and the American Museum of Natural History in New York, the Smithsonian Institution's Asian Art Museum in Washington, D.C., which boasted some of the most important ancient Chinese jades and bronzes in the world, the Tate Gallery and Royal College of Art in London, the Louvre in Paris, the Jewish Museum in Berlin, Columbia, Oxford, Edinburgh, Glasgow, and Salzburg universities, and the medical school at Tel Aviv University. The brothers gave not only in their personal capacity. Their company was also admirably generous to the communities in which it operated. It offered grants to local groups to encourage the healthy development of youth by reducing high-risk behaviors such as substance abuse. It supported organizations that improve quality of life at a national level and in our own communities. It funded education programs to help medical professionals recognize and reduce medication abuse. In the shadow of its headquarters in Connecticut, it funded the Stamford Boys and Girls Club, a provider of services to the homeless, a library, the Stamford Palace Theater, the Connecticut Ballet, the Stamford Symphony, the Stamford Chamber of Commerce, the Business Council of Fairfield County, the Stamford Museum and Nature Center, the Maritime Aquarium, United Way, and Making Strides Against Breast Cancer. In the hubs of power and influence in America and around the world, it was difficult to avoid the generous legacy of the Sacklers. But Walker had now raised the question of whether the givers were obliged not only to contribute to solutions, but also to answer about their role in causing the problems. In business, the Sacklers had engaged in practices that at first raised eyebrows and eventually summoned serious legal problems. Arthur Sackler was, according to the New York Times, widely given credit, some would say blame, for creating many of the drug industry's more aggressive marketing techniques. For example, holding conferences for doctors in which attendees learn about the efficacy of the sponsoring company's drugs. That legacy of aggressive drug marketing affected the promotion of many different medicines, but it was particularly consequential for Purdue Pharma and its affiliated companies, and for American society, in the case of a painkiller called OxyContin, which it began to sell in 1996. OxyContin is a forceful narcotic that provides up to 12 hours of respite from serious pain. At first, it was marketed as a breakthrough, with a time-release formulation that made it less likely to foster addiction and abuse. That claim, the Times reports, became the linchpin of the most aggressive marketing campaign ever undertaken by a pharmaceutical company for a narcotic painkiller. In addition to the wining and dining at conferences, the marketers of OxyContin, including Purdue's partner Abbott Laboratories, were ingenious in their pursuit of doctors, including in the case of an orthopedic surgeon who wouldn't give the drug reps his time until they discovered his weakness, according to Stat, a medical publication. We were told by his nurses and office staff that the best way to capture his attention and develop our relationship was through junk food, the drug reps noted in a memo disclosed by Stat. The reps were swift to act on the advice. An Abbott rep showed up the following week, according to Stat, bearing a box of donuts and other treats. The sweets had been specially arrayed to spell the word OxyContin. This time, the reps got the ear of the doctor. Every week after that, the Abbott sales personnel visited the doctor to ask him to switch at least three patients to OxyContin from other painkillers, Stat reported. Purdue also pursued a strategy of promoting OxyContin to general practitioners who tended to have the disadvantage, or advantage depending on your viewpoint, of less training than specialists, such as orthopedic surgeons, in treating serious pain and in detecting signs of painkiller abuse by patients. There are also, of course, many more general practitioners than there are such specialists. This huge marketing blitz for OxyContin took Purdue from being a small drug maker in the mid-1990s to earning nearly $3 billion in sales in 2001. Four-fifths of that was from OxyContin. Oxy, as it came to be called, was a powerful new weapon against pain, but it also swiftly became a widely abused street drug. It was meant to be swallowed, which allowed for the extended release. But, the Times wrote, both experienced drug abusers and novices, including teenagers, soon discovered that chewing an OxyContin tablet, or crushing one and then snorting the powder, or injecting it with a needle, produced a high as powerful as heroin. And so OxyContin began to be implicated in a growing number of overdoses and deaths, concentrated in rural areas down on their luck. These deaths, around the turn of the millennium, turned out to be early signs of what years later would come to be called a national opioid epidemic. As the New Yorker reports, though many fatal overdoses have resulted from opioids other than OxyContin, the crisis was initially precipitated by a shift in the culture of prescribing, a shift carefully engineered by Purdue. Eventually, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would report that overdose deaths from prescription opioids quadrupled between 1999 and 2014, claiming 14,000 lives in that last year. That same year, nearly 2 million Americans abused or were dependent on prescription opioids, and a quarter of patients who used the drugs for non-cancer purposes battled addiction. The opioids were sending more than 1,000 people a day to emergency rooms. And in online forums, people traded notes about the best ways to get the best highs without killing themselves. R.E. chew or swallow whole? Just keep in mind your tolerance will grow very, very quickly. I ate 280s today since 10 a.m. and snorted one as of 10 p.m. That's with 3 years' experience, and I suffer from two major conditions that require pain treatment, but 2.5 or 2.25 could do it. I let loose on weekends. And it also varies with how much I am active, walking, etc. Be careful, I started with 420 milligrams per day, and now at 300 milligrams per day. You don't want to go through withdrawals if you run out, man. If you could have been with me December 24th last year, I was out 1 week early at this level and had to suffer bad. You don't want to know. Sometimes no one sees a massive social problem like this coming. This was not one of those times. In 2001, as sales of OxyContin and other opioids soared, officials at the State Employee Health Plan in West Virginia noticed something strange. As the insurer for state employees, it received paperwork when they died, including the coroner's account of the cause of death. Officials at the insurer took note of a rising number of deaths attributed to something called oxycodone, the active ingredient in OxyContin, according to STAT. The officials were familiar with the drug because prescriptions for it were exploding among their clients, who ingested $11,000 worth of it in 1996 and $2 million worth in 2002. The officials were quick to speak up. They pushed for regulations that would require doctors to secure prior authorization before prescribing OxyContin, which was intended to confine usage of the drug to people who genuinely needed it and to keep it away from known addicts and others with a record of abusing it. But these efforts met furious resistance from Purdue Pharma. STAT reported that beating back any attempt to limit OxyContin prescriptions became a top priority for Purdue in 2001. A memo obtained by that news outlet, describing the annual goals of the company's West Virginia operation, found, "Stop any pre-authorization efforts for OxyContin," prominent among them. Another memo mentioned a meeting with officials in West Virginia to interrupt any efforts on their part to slow the prescription of OxyContin. As a former Purdue official explained to STAT, "We like to keep prior authorization off of any drug." The official was casting these efforts as flowing from a generic aversion to regulation. Purdue found a clever workaround, using third-party companies known as pharmacy benefits managers to ensure that West Virginians could receive OxyContin without prior authorization. It made an arrangement to pay the benefits managers a rebate if they prescribed the drug without that additional safeguard. Publicly, Purdue worked to project an image in keeping with its charitable spirit and that of its owners, that it existed to help people and was as keen as the state to prevent abuse or harm. Still, according to motions filed by the state's lawyers, contrary to the picture of helpfulness and cooperation Purdue attempts to paint, Purdue's employees were actively and secretly trying to prevent West Virginia from imposing any control on the sale of OxyContin. McDowell County, West Virginia, turned out to be a proverbial canary in a coal mine when it came to the emerging national opioid crisis, Stat noted. Back in 2001, when officials at the insurer first spoke up, the state as a whole was still at 6 deaths per 100,000 residents from opioid overdoses. McDowell was already at 38 per 100,000, however, and its fate foreshadowed West Virginia's, which would see its death rate more than triple in the ensuing decade, giving it the country's highest rate of deaths from overdoses and of painkiller prescriptions in general. Many of those deaths might have been prevented if state officials had not faced the opposition they had to regulating OxyContin prescriptions. The McDowell sheriff, Martin West, said to visiting reporters, "Listen to the scanner here every night. It's first responders out every night going up and down hollers for an overdose. It's pitiful what is going on." Meanwhile, as other public servants around the country began to worry about the drug's propensity for addiction and abuse, Purdue pushed back, according to the Times, claiming that the drug's long-acting quality made it less likely to be abused than traditional narcotics. The U.S. Department of Justice disagreed. "OxyContin was not what Purdue claimed it was," in the words of John Brownlee, who was then the U.S. attorney in Roanoke, Virginia. Purdue's assertions that OxyContin was less addictive and less subject to abuse and diversion were false, and the company knew its claims were false. Purdue's misrepresentations contributed to a serious national problem in terms of abuse of this prescription drug. The drug's fraudulent promotion, he added, had a devastating effect on many communities throughout Virginia and the United States. Brownlee brought charges against Purdue, which in 2007 agreed to settle. It acknowledged that it had marketed OxyContin with the intent to defraud or mislead, and it agreed to pay $635 million in fines and other outlays. It was one of the largest fines ever paid in such a case, but only an inconvenience when compared to how lucrative OxyContin was becoming. In 2015, Forbes declared the Sackler family the richest newcomer to its annual list of wealthy families, with a net worth of $14 billion. Noting that the family had edged out storied families like the Bushes, Mellons, and Rockefellers, it asked, "How did the Sacklers build the 16th largest fortune in the country?" The short answer? Making the most popular and controversial opioid of the 21st century, OxyContin. Another answer to that question might be by thwarting the guardians of the public good every time they tried to protect citizens. It was later reported that Brownlee had received an unusual phone call the night before securing Purdue's guilty plea. A senior Justice Department official, Michael Elston, had called Brownlee on his cell phone and urged him to slow down, according to the Washington Post. Brownlee rebuffed his superior. 8 days later, the Post said, his name appeared on a list compiled by Elston of prosecutors that officials had suggested be fired. It was part of a larger attempted purge of prosecutors by the administration of George W. Bush. Brownlee kept his job. Elston lost his amid the controversy of the lists becoming public. And what had occasioned the phone call? According to Elston, his boss, a deputy attorney general named Paul McNulty, had asked him to place the call to Brownlee after receiving a request for more time from a defense lawyer representing a Purdue executive. The Sacklers were just one family out of many in America who might have been inspired by Walker's essay to look at the past. What Walker was drawing their attention to was not just their own conduct, but the playing field on which they had played, the system in which their advantages had formed. Despite the easily available knowledge about Oxy and the Sacklers, Market World embraced the family's do-gooding and kept mum about the harm. The most common single-word descriptor for members of the family became philanthropist. Generosity is not a substitute for justice. But here, as so often in market world, it was allowed to stand in. The institutions that benefited from the Sacklers' largesse have shown little interest in demanding that they atone for any role they might have played in fomenting a national crisis. The generosity tended to be in places where influential people gathered, whereas the injustice tended to happen out of view in places like McDowell County, whose storytelling apparatus had little chance of competing with a headline about a gift to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The generosity was in the millions. The injustice had helped to build a $14 billion fortune. According to the New Yorker, 200,000 Americans have died from overdoses related to OxyContin and other prescription opioids since 1999. In his letter, Darren Walker, paraphrasing Dr. King, called for givers like the Sacklers not only to give, but also to bend the demand curve toward justice. It wouldn't be easy. The Lincoln was at 49th Street and 3rd Avenue. Walker was talking about how he tries to reach people, be they philanthropists like the Sacklers, executives like those at KKR, or any of the other wealthy and powerful people among whom he moves. The key, he said, adopting a pair of beloved modern phrases, is to meet people where they are and not be judgmental. Here he made an analogy that was revealing about Walker's own way of looking at things. When he worked in Harlem, it was hard getting parents to bring kids to medical appointments. There was a temptation to judge and criticize. Here we are trying to help you, and you can't even get up off your couch. Walker said he knew that was not the right approach. He knew they would have their own logic, their own story. You don't knock on the door and say, you're a loser, you're a bad... You've got to meet people where they are. That's my view writ large, he continued. And so, where we're meeting them, he was now speaking of the highly privileged, is where they are, which is they actually believe that they are doing good, they are contributing to our economy, they're contributing to the tax base, they are contributing to philanthropy through their own personal giving and commitments to boards and whatever. So that's where they are. The analogy is telling, because it illustrates how an ethic of not judging that had developed to protect the weak could serve just as well to guard the strong. Meeting people where they are means one thing when applied to a mother with mental health issues in Harlem, juggling three jobs, two kids, and their appointments. It is quite another thing for the private equity tycoon to enjoy that same suspension of judgment. Should he, like the subaltern, really be met wherever he is? Ensconced in the Lincoln, Walker said that the concentration of wealth and power in our time was causing a hollowing out of the middle class and a huge blowback of populism, of nationalism, of xenophobia. Around the world, the politics of anger and revenge were on the rise, he said, because people are truly feeling the pain in a way we have never felt in modern times. Rich people didn't want to talk about that, though. They wanted to talk about opportunity. Okay, I'll meet you there, Walker said. Let's talk about opportunity. Still, it irritated him to sit in a boardroom or living room and hear yet another elderly white tycoon who inherited much of his money explain why it's not about inequality. He said in the car what he doesn't say to those tycoons, but seemed to fantasize about telling them. You are allowed to live in a world where you don't have to deal with reality. Yet, Walker said again, gearing up for KKR, I'll meet you where you are. Many in market world have no interest in asking themselves Walker's questions about how their money was made. But there are others who are inclined to ask those questions, and yet struggle to let themselves truly go there and escape their own web of justifications. Kat Cole is the chief operating officer of Focus Brands, the private equity-owned company behind Cinnabon, Auntie Anne's, Moe's Southwest Grill, Carvel, and other food purveyors. Unlike many philanthropists whose fortunes were already amassed, Cole is an operating businesswoman who still has a chance to follow both the taking and giving aspects of Walker's new gospel. At the same time, her life offers a case study in the reasons and rationalizations that the gospel finds itself up against. Cole started working at Hooters at 17. She joined a business that has long been morally controversial to some, for the same reason so many people do. Survival. She grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, in a family that was at first middle class. Her parents' household was the only one in the extended clan with two cars. They worked white-collar jobs. Many of their relatives lived in trailer parks and revolved in and out of work, junkyards, factories, trucking, of jail, and of addictive substances. Cole's father was an alcoholic. He was gone all the time, she said, and was no longer a reliable husband or father, leaving his wife miserable and the family unstable. When Cole was 9, her mother came to her and said, "That's it. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we got to go." As Cole, who prides herself on her pragmatism, remembers it, she didn't even become upset. "I just thought, what took you so long?" Her mother soon headed a much poorer household, with a $10-a-week food budget for herself and 3 daughters. Their diet was heavy on Spam, potted meat, beanie weenies, and sloppy joes. Cole's mother continued to work as a secretary and took on side jobs nights and weekends. Within a few years, she would remarry, and the home would gain some stability. But the years of living close to poverty shaped Kat, who would spend her career wondering about her responsibilities to others without a surfeit of luck or good options. Cole began selling clothes at the mall when she was 15. In her junior year of high school, she took the Hooters job. The following year, she was promoted from hostess to waitress, and in this new role was earning enough to drop the retail job and still save up for college. Though the restaurant promoted its server's breasts as a selling point and boasted of being delightfully tacky, yet unrefined, Cole found it empowering. Here she was, as a high school and then a college student, making as much as $400 a shift. For the record, Cole insists, against all odds and ads, that the chain has never promoted breasts, but rather sells overall sex appeal. She was a good and versatile waitress. If someone was needed to come off the floor and sling wings, she could do it. If a bartender went missing, she could tend bar. These skills got her noticed by managers, and when Hooters Corporate came looking for talent, her name surfaced. At 20, she switched to management at headquarters. She traveled the world, opening up new franchises. Her pay and duties grew swiftly year by year. She became a star. In the role she would later come to occupy, she would serve as something of a role model for aspiring female leaders, asked to mentor young women and to speak to them at conferences. She was a complicated role model, since she was doing it all for Hooters. At first, she had seen no contradiction between her own empowerment through Hooters and the fact of what Hooters was. The chain was part of the Jacksonville landscape. In Florida, that just wasn't that big of a deal, really, she said. That location had been around since Cole was very young. In high school, it was where everyone ended up on Saturday nights, the baseball guys, the football guys, the cheerleaders. It didn't feel foreign, it didn't feel shady, it didn't feel that it was exploiting women, because you'd go in and the girls were having so much fun. And when you're a high school girl and you see these beautiful women that are having fun, they are very much in control in their roles, they're almost little celebrities in their own way. That seemed really aspirational, actually. They also seemed a lot happier than the servers at Applebee's. Moreover, the company put women in leadership positions, and as it grew, often promoted from within, which much of the time meant turning skimpily clad waitresses into managers. "So my immediate view from the inside was, this place is awesome for women," Cole said. There were moments when men got drunk and hit on Hooters girls. Cole had friends who worked at Applebee's, though, where the same thing happened, if not as often. "I saw nothing but women's empowerment all around me," she said. She was enormously grateful for all Hooters had done for her, and defensive on its behalf. When she moved to management and gave out her business cards at a conference, she would watch people look down at that owl logo, and she would see the judgment fill their eyes. She still remembers the woman who said, "How dare you not just work for, but be part of the growth of a company that exploits women?" Cole answered her by telling her something she had come to believe. "We don't exploit women, we employ them." Cole was laying the foundation for the system of rationalizations that so many business people must construct to quiet their own doubts and the doubts of others. There was tangible good that she could see, and that was enough for her. She did not open herself to questions about her company's negative contributions to a larger system that was abstract and hard to make sense of. Cole eventually became an executive vice president at Hooters. And when she reached those heights, she rationalized that whatever harm people might perceive was offset by good deeds. She worked on a tuition reimbursement program that helped put women through college. She created a resume writing program to help people who were leaving the chain to articulate the experience they had in the best way that would minimize the judgment we knew they would get. Eventually, though, Cole decided that she didn't want Hooters to be her only story. She went back to school, earning an MBA, despite not having a bachelor's degree, on evenings and weekends. She was recruited by a private equity firm and named president of one of its portfolio companies, Cinnabon. Later, she was promoted to a senior executive role at its parent company, Focus Brands. For the Cinnabon job, new rationalizations were needed. Cole was responsible for putting out into the world many food items that people were probably better off avoiding. She rationalized this by insisting on calling Cinnabon a bakery. She said, "It's literally a bakery, which has been around for centuries." She seemed to hear herself, and she added a point. "We're just adding a shitload more sugar, and that is a meaningful change from the bakeries of 200 years ago." This rather audacious rationalization, mingled with other, more plausible-sounding ones, such as that if there were going to be bad industries, good people should run them. If in a free market society there will be demand, whether it's for sugary products, or alcohol, or scantily clad waitresses in a restaurant concept, then it will exist, she said. And so if it exists, what matters is the how. This rationalization was important, because it suggested not only that it was acceptable for someone like Cole to devote her talent to an organization like Hooters or Cinnabon, but also that it might be preferable to using it somewhere nobler. If places like these were going to exist in a free market, and what mattered was how they were run, then not working there would solve nothing. It would in fact increase the likelihood that the wrong leaders, pursuing the wrong how, would end up there in your stead. Cole also told herself that she had done her duty by leveling with the public about Cinnabon's roles. She said, "We call it what it is. We tell you it's made full of sugar and fat. It's marketed as an indulgence. And even when I would do media, I would say, you shouldn't eat this for breakfast, lunch, and dinner." Once again, it was important to zoom in and ignore the issue of systems and structures, the larger, more complicated issues of poor dietary habits, nutrition options, and obesity. Cole regarded her attempt at transparency about a harmful product as a more authentic form of corporate virtue than the moral offsetting that Carnegie promoted. She said she steered her brands away from giving back to the very problems they may have helped to cause. Doing that wouldn't be right, in her view. What is probably disingenuous is to go support the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation. She suggested that telling customers your product is potentially harmful to them and not intended for regular consumption is a better way to outweigh, in one's moral calculus, the effect of advertising it and selling it to them. Cole's rationalizations were strongly and sincerely held. If Darren Walker wanted to change the money-making system itself, to change how business is conducted, he was not only up against powerful corporate interests and their lobbyists, he was also up against the psychologies of thousands of people like Cole, and a way of looking at life that didn't require cynicism or callousness to commit harm. It was a way of viewing things that inured the viewer to the larger systems around you, that made those systems not your problem. Some months before Walker's visit to KKR, he was sitting in his office, thinking about the award the philanthropist Laurie Tisch would be giving him that evening at the Museum of Modern Art. Tisch would also be doing a little dinner for 80 afterwards at the St. Regis. And Walker was excited, because as with the KKR luncheon, he felt that events like this were opportunities to be disruptive. Not to say, "Shame on you, rich people," he said, but to just ask questions and to interrogate and to talk about things that make people uncomfortable, like wealth and race and privilege and justice, and the role that we all play in having more or less justice. Walter Isaacson, the president of the Aspen Institute, one of the temples of Market World, would be interviewing him on stage, and Walker knew exactly what Isaacson would want. Darren Walker's improbable life story. "I can assure you Walter will prompt that, and he always does, and that's fine," Walker said. "That's the idea, and so part of my approach is to give him what he wants. It's to give him the story to remind people that we have lived in a country where people like me can realize their dream." But this was only half of the cocktail Walker wished to deliver. At the same time, we have to say, all right, so you believe in the story, right? He mimicked the coos of the adoring, mostly white crowd. Yes, we believe in the story. We believe in your story. And then you have to help people paint a picture that stories like mine won't be nearly as achieved, as realized in the future. My journey, my story, could never be possible today because of all the things we know. When I got on the mobility escalator, all the things along that journey that helped propel me forward, in many ways, either aren't there anymore, or are weaker, or in fact they would push me backwards. The delicate art of a night like this, he said, was to make the plutocrats feel good about America, and make them feel good about themselves, and, having softened them with those feelings, persuade them that their America has to change. Tisch is a philanthropist who was already warm to Walker's call for fundamental change and a new conversation about justice, but who also struggled with how to get there. She was an heir to a family fortune that estimates put at $21 billion. Her late father, Preston Robert Tisch, was a founder of the Lowe's Corporation, where the family made most of its money. It was one of the more visibly generous families in America, especially in New York, where the Tisch name is ubiquitous on the edifices of good causes. Thanks to this giving, Lori was co-chair of the Board of Trustees of the Whitney Museum of American Art, vice-chair of the Board of Trustees of Lincoln Center, a trustee of the Aspen Institute, and former chair of the Center for Arts Education and the Children's Museum of Manhattan. She was also a co-owner of the New York Giants football team. By the standards of her fellow plutocrats, Tisch was ambivalent about her fortune. Late one morning, not long ago, she sat in a banquette corner at the Regency Bar and Grill at a Lowe's hotel in New York, talking of why she had always seen herself as an outlier in her family. Maybe it was because she grew up the lone female in her generation of Tisches, encircled by two brothers and four male cousins. She was, she said proudly, the first woman born a Tisch, which was a watered-down version of a name too alien-sounding for the America of the early 20th century, when her grandparents emigrated from Russia, setting down fresh roots in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. Tisch, now in her middle 60s, recalled her days as a student at the University of Michigan in the final years of the Vietnam War. She was involved in what she hedgingly called kind of radical politics, think campus rallies, no bomb throwing. She and her comrades tried to bar ROTC from recruiting at Michigan. Although she came from one of the great new fortunes of the era, she says she thought capitalism was a bad word. One day, midway through college, she informed her parents that she was planning to drive to Washington for a big protest march. "Let me just get this straight," she recalled one of them answering. "So you're going to go to Washington to yell 'Smash the corporations' in the car that we bought? Just saying." A car bought thanks to the money from their growing corporation. She ended up not going. To be Lori Tisch back then was to be both against the system and the embodiment of the system you were against. And, she said with a laugh, it meant having a headache all the time. And while her ideas and tactics have evolved over the years, that basic conflict and that headache have never left her. The conflict filled her with a guilt that grew over the years. It was a guilt that her rich friends seem not to feel or even understand when they tell her to get that facial, jet over to that spa, acquire that painting. "Of course you should do it. You deserve it," she says they tell her. The guilt made her say to herself, "I deserve it because I inherited a lot of money?" She once mentioned the guilt to Darren Walker, who in fact thought such guilt was justified and had bet his career on the idea that giving isn't enough. But he was too gallant to tell her that. "He kind of talked me down from it," she said. To rebut her sense of complicity in injustice, he praised her generosity. "That's ridiculous. Look at what you're doing." But even Walker wasn't charming enough to wash the guilt away. Tisch said she has spent most of her life racked by it. "Being at war with myself, or being a little bit schizophrenic, a little bit tortured." She likes to joke that nonprofits that want to raise money from her should track her credit card bills, because when her spending surges, her guilt rises in tandem, along with her inclination to give back. For Tisch, though, the guilt was not just an emotional problem to manage. It was also a spur to believe and do the right things as she saw them. "When are you ever going to get rid of the guilt?" a friend of hers asked long ago. After all, she had given so much. "Hopefully never," Tish replied. "It's my compass." The guilt doesn't absolve her of benefiting from a system that she thinks unjust, but it does keep her from forgetting that fact, and it inspires her to do what she can. Among her reasons for starting her personal foundation was, she said, taking it away from guilt and turning it into something more useful. But it will always be there a little bit. It is there in part because she knows that the giving she does is not institutional change or systemic change, she said. "I'm going to leave that to my kids." But if she was being honest, the guilt also gives her something she is reluctant to part with. A sense of superiority over rich people, less guilty and more indulgent than she is. Tish's guilt and feelings of complicity could make her a good target for Walker's new gospel, a gospel centered on a fairer, less guilt-inducing economic system, not just latter-day giving. But when actually confronted with what a different system might mean for her, her instincts of self-protection begin to overwhelm those of guilt. Does she believe that inheritances should be taxed more heavily than at present, as is the case in many other countries? She squirmed. "I mean, ideally, definitely, there shouldn't be such a gap between the rich and the poor. There shouldn't," she said. But did she believe that the society would have been better off had she not been able to inherit as much as she had? That was harder for her. "I'm lucky that I can do what I can do," she said of the philanthropy that her inheritance has allowed her to engage in. "But do I think it's the most fair system? Probably not." So then, should she have been taxed more? Should her children's inheritances be taxed more? "You'd have to be a better student of history than I am," she said. "I mean, that's kind of the aspirational dream." What she seemed to be suggesting was that higher taxes on people like her family were the right idea in theory, but maybe only in theory. And sometimes she was unsure even of that. If rich people's children didn't inherit large fortunes, wouldn't they continue chasing money, going to Wall Street or wherever, and having less time to spend on helping people? Did she believe that a society with less hereditary wealth would be better? "Would it be better," she said? "I mean, it's probably better not to be poor." Could she then support such changes? "That's why I said I'm not a student of history, because that's kind of aspirational," Tish said. In other words, it is a utopian idea that perhaps sounded good, but she maintained that she didn't know enough to embrace it. "But," she added a moment later, "in countries where they're closer to that, is that a better society? Probably. But places like Scandinavia, where there is less poverty, had, it should be noted, less money lying around for people like Tish to give away." "You don't need to give away as much," she said. "You don't need to treat so many symptoms when the diseases are fewer." Yet while we have the system we do, was there any way she saw to reconcile her abstract positions with the way she actually lived? She didn't seem to think so. "I guess it's the same on some level as our last president or any president being very pro-public education and sending their kids to private school. I don't have an easy answer," she says. Her life and ideals similarly collide over the question of the influence of wealthy people like her on politics. Does she believe such influence should be curbed? "You think it's great in theory, but you don't want to be the only schmuck doing it," she says. She believed the campaign finance system to be unjust, and understood the link between that injustice and the drowned-out voices and social exclusion that she later seeks to alleviate through philanthropy. "And yet when it came to supporting Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign," she said, "how many fundraisers did I go to at $25,000 and $50,000? Tish's ex-husband, Donald Sussman, has been very public in making the case for what may appear to be the twisted logic of the anti-mega-donor mega-donor. Sussman, a hedge fund manager, reportedly contributed $40 million to Democratic super PACs and other outside groups, making him, by some accounts, Clinton's biggest supporter in 2016. He told the Washington Post he was inspired by his wish to remove the influence of big donors like himself. "It's very odd to be giving millions when your objective is to actually get the money out of politics," he told the Post. "I am a very strong supporter of publicly financed campaigns, and I think the only way to accomplish that is to get someone like Secretary Clinton, who is committed to cleaning up the unfortunate disaster created by the activist court in Citizens United. In order to change the status quo, you have to give in to the status quo." This difficulty in escaping the status quo was especially evident in Tish when it came to the aspect of her fortune that gave her the greatest guilt, her cigarette money. In 1968, Lowe's had capitalized on growing public health concerns over smoking by buying a cigarette company at a bargain price, as the New York Times put it. Its acquisition, Lorillard, produced Newport cigarettes, which were controversial for targeting African Americans, with a product more alluring and more lethal than most, laced with a menthol flavor that made it easier to start smoking and a higher-than-average nicotine content that helped keep one hooked. When 7 tobacco executives famously sat side by side in Congress in 1994 and denied cigarettes' harmful effects, Lori's cousin Andrew was one of them. When asked if he thought that smoking and cancer were connected, he said, "I do not believe that." The following year, Lori's uncle, Lawrence, then the chairman of CBS, aroused anger when his network killed a 60 Minutes segment about the tobacco industry whistleblower who would eventually be portrayed in the movie The Insider. The segment ran only after Lowe's announced its intention to sell the network. Lori Tisch knew these things, and she had to know that people had died because of those cigarettes and those self-serving deceptions. She sometimes thought about the cigarettes when people thanked her for promoting the arts or investing in young lives or giving grants to support more healthy food in African-American communities like Harlem. It was hard to know whether the debt would ever be repaid, whether the lives saved would ever catch up with the lives that were stolen. But Tisch said she had this guilty reaction when the people thanking her didn't know about the cigarette money. On other occasions, she said, "They do know it, and I get defensive." She wondered aloud, "Are cigarettes worse than alcohol? Is alcohol worse than sugar? So I also get defensive when I get criticized for it, that my family shouldn't give to the hospital or do this or that." It bothered her when she heard people say that tobacco money had no place in a hospital dedicated to saving lives. Why should her family be the only schmucks singled out for harmful products? Still, Tisch, outfitted with that compass of guilt, ventured past her own defensiveness. "I do think that good, solid people can generally rationalize taking advantage of the system," she said. "And how do they rationalize it? By telling themselves that this is the system we have. That's how it is," she said. "Why should I be the only fool?" In her reluctance to be the only fool, Tisch was revealing the hold that the status quo had on her. Again and again she had voiced an ideal for which, in the end, she was unwilling to sacrifice. It was important to her to feel superior to her rich friends, but she was unwilling to rush out in front of them and be the only one not to take advantage of a system she knew to be wrong. Her repeated confessions that she will not be the one to bring about the world that she swears she believes in sent a message to Darren Walker. If he wants a fairer system, he is going to have to seek it in spite of people like her, not with them at his side. He might have their moral support, but he could not count on them to make the decisions to change the system that made them everything that they are. The people who get to take advantage of the system? Why would they really want to change it? Tisch said at one point. They'll maybe give more money away, but they don't want to radically change it. Was there anything she could imagine that would convince them otherwise, that could inspire them to pursue a fairer system? "Revolution, maybe," she said. At last, Walker's limousine pulled up to 9 West 57th Street, and he was whisked upstairs. A cheerful receptionist took custody of his camel overcoat and furry hat. Janice Cook Roberts, who led investor relations at KKR and is the daughter of the legendary Washington power broker Vernon Jordan, exchanged pleasantries with Walker about her father. Then Walker ran into another executive, Ken Mailman, who helped to advance the Republican Party's anti-gay agenda as its chairman until he came out as gay a few years after stepping down and began to fight for gay rights. Like Carnegie, he had done what he had to do and was now in the redemption phase, albeit one pursued while working at KKR. The session was held in a large room with a buffet off to one side. The room was filled with elegant white leather chairs. The crowd was young, mostly junior employees. They had the look of people who are living without rising to the level of being alive. Walker had said that in his experience, many such employees show up at these events because they nourish dreams of quitting and becoming doers of good. Yet for now they carried themselves with a boredom and alienation that was a high-end analog of what one detected in the workers at Walmart. You got into this room by making the right, careful choices over and over again. Like Cat Cole, you learned to zoom in and not ask questions about what larger things you were abetting. And because the firm knew at some level what psychological sacrifice all this demanded, it had the decency to put on a speaker series for you, where museum chieftains and healthcare experts and this foundation president, people living closer to their truths than you, could inspire you a little. Walker, visibly exuberant about his mission, offered a striking contrast to his audience. Was he going to tell them they were responsible for the rise of nationalism globally? That the world he wanted would lower them a few pegs? Was he going to say that their business practices were part of the problem, or that they needed to pay higher taxes? Would he meet them where they were? Was it possible to do all these things? On that day, at least, no. Walker, in his opening remarks, referred a few times to Henry Kravis, one of KKR's founders, as a philanthropist. He was no longer a corporate raider, a pioneer of the kind of value extraction Walker deplored in the limo. Walker spoke highly of his own experience in the financial services industry. It had given him skills, some of which, presumably, were the protocols that he could now tell himself he had redeployed in service of the week. It taught him how to multitask, manage a complex portfolio of projects, assimilate data, and turn it into insight, have discipline. He wasn't flattering his audience. He was reciting the reasons why so many people like Hillary Cohen, who aspired to help millions of people, went to places like KKR before embarking on their work of changing the world. Walker tried to keep the room comfortable by turning philanthropy into a relative concept. "If you say philanthropy in America, it means a lot of different things," he said. "It means individual philanthropists like Henry and many people who you know and many of you, because many of you are also philanthropists, even though you may not call yourself a philanthropist." Eventually, he got to the subject at hand. "We have in America and in the world a level of extreme inequality that, I don't mean to be hyperbolic, but I think really threatens our democracy. Because at the core of the American narrative in our democracy is a very simple idea of opportunity." That's how he did it, poking them with a thought that might not have been their favorite, and then quickly meeting them where they were, with the language of opportunity, that market world staple. And then, unsurprisingly, he told the story of the charity hospital in Lafayette and all the rest of it. He talked about how there was a mobility escalator that I could get on, about the leverage of opportunity in American society. In the car, he had said that the wealthy, believing that America has an opportunity problem, but not an inequality one, are allowed to live in a world where you don't have to deal with reality. Now, in front of a new generation of the barbarians at the gate, he was meeting them where they were. "The more inequality we get in our system, the less opportunity there is," he said. He closed in more personal terms. "I challenge myself about my own privilege every day, and say, you know, you're incredibly privileged. You have cousins who were definitely as smart as you, and they ended up in prison. Why did that happen? And so everything is a conversation in my own little head about privilege and about being in places like these with people like you, who are clearly smart, ambitious, and want to make a difference in the world, and are privileged." It was not, in fact, evident that the people in the room wanted to make a difference in the way that Walker suggested. That became clear when question and answer time came. The first question was about his leadership style and how he motivated employees, a business person trying to learn from him how to be better at business. The second was about global security. The third was about whether there was too much charitable money chasing too few capable do-gooders. Walker had been subtle, verging on silent, about what he said in the car about private equity's complicity in inequality, about what they needed to do less rather than more of. And his subtlety and their imperviousness had conspired to ensure that he was not really heard. Back in the limo, Walker said he could tell the group hadn't really grasped or connected with his new gospel material. He had found solace, however, in two women toward the back of the room who were nodding on all of those issues. He said, "The white guys at the front table, they were like sort of motionless." They had been, except when one of them heard a variant of the phrase, "paid no taxes," which came up a few times in describing the setup of the Ford Foundation. Then he had nodded. Walker knew, of course, that he had been speaking to the associates of the firm, not its rainmakers. He had been addressing people still in the fearful climbing season of their lives. To get the rainmakers, he said, you had to be in more private settings. You get the people like that in one-on-ones or at an event, you know, like the one where I was the other night where there was a bunch of very rich white guys, he said. And so they're all together at somebody's house for a drink, whatever, and it's safe. He added a moment.